Before you listen to this podcast, you can subscribe to The Critic, Britain's best in-print periodical, for just £25 for 5 issues. Subscribe now at www.thecritic.co.uk.
Welcome back to Critical Mash, the place where we celebrate the things that make life worth living, even as The Critic magazine reverts to steam power to keep the lights on. Thank you to President Trump. So this time we're moving away from our usual cross-cultural pursuits to concentrate on a single show. But that single show is Wagner's Siegfried, the third instalment of the ongoing Ring Cycle at Covent Garden, which is, and any Ring Cycle being rather a momentous thing in opera, particularly this one perhaps, because as I was watching it, I was thinking, this is probably the last Ring at a national house we will see in our lifetimes. I can't see any of the other Welsh opera nor Scottish doing it. And we'll cover ENO, keep cancelling, you know, so I just don't know. I mean, but it seems to be like most opera has been privatised now. It's being done in country houses. And they're doing it at Grange Park in summer. Wasfy is doing Grime Girls, you know that?
Excellent. Yeah. No, I didn't, but okay. I will now immediately go and sign
and
up.
They got a very good thing for... Anyway, so that's just something which occurred to me. And also, of course, anything about Wagner and Siegfried is not about one thing, because Wagner wanted Siegfried to kind of redeem the world and transform it, and also to induce world revolution and all kinds of other things. So it's kind of about everything as well. And so here we have to talk about this, three various opera maniacs, slightly unusual. None of them professional opera maniacs like me, but it's all the better for that. Penny Smith, eminent broadcaster and writer and maker of excellent margaritas, I understand. And I think you're an opera omnivore, are you, Penny?
I am. I can't stop scoffing it. I came to London when I was 30, sort of been broadcasting and working around England, and also Hong Kong, actually, and came to London when I was 30, and I was walking past the Opera House, always been an opera fan from a young age, and I was walking past the Opera House, and outside it said, tickets from £3.50. And I thought, well, shovel me sideways and call me Kevin. If it's that cheap, I can afford to go and sit there and see whether I like seeing it performed. And that was the start of a relationship where essentially I think there's nary a seat anywhere at a London opera house where I haven't sat. I love it. Yeah, can't stop.
But not particularly, I mean, you're not only a Wagnerian or anything. You do the lot.
I was late to Wagner, funnily enough. The first opera I saw at the opera house was Il Trovatore. And I didn't love it, but I liked it enough to carry on going back. And the first time I dipped a toe in Wagner, I think I was in my 40s, and I genuinely sat there. I think it was Parsifal, probably not the best one to start with, except it has got cracking tunes. It's just that it's quite dull on stage. But I sat there, and apart from about, I don't know, 20 minutes where I thought sublime, brilliant, gorgeous, I spent a lot of time thinking, these people are putting it on. Why they don't really enjoy this rubbish, this cacophony, this going onness, this absolute rollocks of a story and what the hell's going on. And now, of course, can't...
You're one of them. You've auto-hypnotised into that Wagnerian state. OK, Dr. Lola Salem... formerly resident, but no longer resident, I think, Lola. I mean, I don't know what's going on. Art critic, opera scholar, cultural policy consultant, and all number of other things. Lola, I think you're basically a French Baroque girl rather than a Wagner girl, aren't you? What's the deal here?
I think I was exposed to all sorts of type of music, including opera, when I was very young. And so I went from 20th century stuff to 17th century and 18th century very quickly, back and forth. And then the 19th century sort of started dripping actually throughout all of that experience. So I don't think Wagner was and probably that's a good thing when you're very young, was the first starter. But he came very quickly. And I wouldn't say I'm a massive fan, as in, like, I like it, but I'm not sort of, you know, looking for it with a sort of passion. But when it's well done, I really, really, really like it. And I think we're gonna see if indeed we liked it or not. But it's this sort of art where, as you said earlier, we can talk about it in so many different ways. It's never, it's always a font of pleasure and ideas and passion that is never getting dry.
Mm, this is it. And why we still maniacally go along to every time we see it's going to be on. And last but by no means least, Paul Lay, historian, presently senior editor at Engelsberg Ideas. And I have a feeling that you're kind of a cradle Wagnerian, Paul. I don't know why.
Well, not really, no. I mean, it's interesting that the first time I went to the Royal Opera House, and this is over 40 years ago now, was to see another German cycle. But it was Stockhausen's Donner Staghaus Licht. That was my first introduction to the Royal Opera House. Because I'd come into classical music with no kind of formal education towards it, but through the avant-garde ends of pop music and jazz and various stuff like that. So I worked my way backwards, in a way, from the avant-garde right through back to, you know, Haydn and Bach and what's normally the other way round. And like Penny, the first Wagner I ever saw was actually Parsifal as well. Mm. And I was just absolutely struck by the whole kind of dreamy, heady beauty of the whole thing. I just thought it was staggering. And he still staggers me now when I hear Parsifal. I think it's just as the most beautiful, particularly the first act, the most sublime, brilliant work of art that is imaginable. And so I've seen, God knows, I think 12 ring cycles now, something like that. I will turn up to anything.
You win. I think you win today's thing. Okay. Well, in which case, Paul, I think you've answered my, I was wondering who to ask this, but I'll ask you. So you've seen 12. How's this one going?
Pretty good, I think. I like the fact that it's quite stark. I think it's well cast. So I think Christopher Maltman has been a revelation as Wotan, because I'd always associated Maltman as being, you know, he's a Schubertian, he's a leader singer. There's something that's very lyrical about him. But I think I've always liked lyrical Wagner, by which I mean probably my favourite recording that I listen to most is Clemens Krauss's Bayreuth recording, which is almost like chamber music. And it's a point that Barry Kosky makes in the programme notes. There's this idea, because most people who don't know Wagner see it through the Ride of the Valkyries, they see it through the Bombast, but actually that's incredibly rare in Wagner.
As people who come along hoping to hear the Ride of the Valkyries
exactly,
find out.
Exactly.
They have six hours and then they get 5 minutes.
Yeah. It's basically people talking about what's just happened, what's going to happen. It's entirely conversational. There's almost no action at all. And so this one works quite well because it's spare. It's the orchestra is fantastic. I always had my doubts years ago about whether Pappano, who is, you know, so Italianate, could really be a great Wagnerian conductor, but I think he is.
Do you?
I think there's something that, for the same reason that I think I love the Krauss, I think there's something lyrical about it. Mm. And there is that Italianate. And I think there's always that in Wagner. You know, he was a man seduced by the South there. And I think that helps. He's not the only way of doing Wagner, but I think it's one that's illustrative. And I think if you have that kind of lyrical cast, then I think it can work.
Mm. What about, I mean, Lola, have you seen, did you see Rheingold and Valkyrie in this cycle?
No, not okay. This cycle. I've right. seen Rheingold in another cycle.
Okay, so I'll ask Penny this question then. Let's go. Okay. So, I mean, in terms of, how do you think, where do you think it's, have you got an impression of like where he's going, what the ideas of this one are?
I'm interested to see what happens in Gotterdammit.
We're going to have to wait till the last
Mima,
frame,
for example, when Mima. He was talking about having this baby that Siegfried sort of foisted upon him. Yeah. It's the first time that I actually thought, do you know what? Actually, it is a bit annoying having a baby foisted upon you when you don't really want it. And there you are, you're bringing it up and it's a horrible little oik. And it that seems to say nothing. It throws your... It's, food back at
your university. Although he did kind of want the child, because it was going to be his key to getting...
No, I know that. I'm just saying that I just felt for the first time in this particular ring cycle, it was the first time that I didn't think Mima was a horrid little...
Do you know what Mima reminds me of? The mother in Butterflies. Remember the Butterflies of the 70s, Carla Lane thing
with Wendy Craig.
And she's this kind of put upon suburban housewife with these two very ungrateful, awful teenage children who just kind of loaf around doing nothing. Yeah. And she has this kind of rich fantasy life. But they're always being rude about her cooking. It's exactly the same. Yeah. I have a feeling that Carla Lane was actually doing Siegfried in TV sitcom form.
Wagner goes Butterflies.
Yeah.
Excellent.
But it's kind of difficult to be sympathetic with Mima, isn't it?
I was not saying I was completely sympathetic. I just, for the first time ever, you know, when you have somebody, I remember when Rolando Villazon played Lenski in Eugene Onegin, and for the first time ever, I actually felt sorry for Lenski, whereas normally I just think, that's an idiot. Oh, for goodness sake. Yeah, I hope Eugene Onegin, you know, and he does every time. Gets it in the neck, literally.
It's an amazing thing. I heard Fritz Wunderlich on a record singing the Lenski things, and suddenly in German, and suddenly you think, oh my God, I see.
Lenski's Lament.
Lenski is like the centre of it. He's not some kind of dreadful weed. And the same, I was watching something the other day, which was, I'll come back to it, exactly the same thing happened, where it was Don Giovanni, where Don Ottavio, who is usually tiresome weed, go away. Yeah. Was absolutely the centre, and he was the one teaching everybody what love is. And the only person who didn't get it was Giovanni. It was the tragedy, but it's an amazing thing. So if you get the right singers and the right, you know...
The right production, because it does make a difference, which is why when you said right at the beginning, you said, why do we keep going back to the same productions? Well, we go because each time that I've gone to see exactly the same thing, I mean, sometimes even exactly the same production, but obviously with a different cast, each time I go... I get something different out of it. Now, it's not necessarily something I want. Like, for example, this is Barry Kosky's Ring Cycle. I disliked intensely his production of Carmen for all sorts of reasons.
Carmen or Carmelites?
Carmen and the Carmelites. Right. Funny enough, Carmen at the Opera House.
Oh, with a gorilla suit.
Just the whole thing. Just I found, and those endless steps. But and the Carmelites, the throwing on of those shoes randomly during one of the bits that normally makes me cry, and I always get annoyed when people don't do don't allow me to do my crying thing. Since that's why I like going to the opera. But I thought this was really good, apart from the wandering naked old woman, which
we'll come to Erda. I mean, because she's clearly a growing problem. I mean, I'd say a growing problem with diminishing returns all the way through. It's just incredible. Anyway, so Lola, you came fresh to this, and in the sense, you know, I mean, obviously, you know, you've heard Wagner before, as you pointed out. But, you know, and so you were pitched into Siegfried. Do you feel... deprived that you didn't feel the first two, or was it a good unitary experience?
Yeah, I think it's good to have all sorts of different experiences when it comes to opera, and I think everyone has already agreed that Wagner in particular, but any other type of opera that is so rich and thick and layered, always offers different ways to, you know, different perspectives and ways to come back at it, or to like it or to dislike it or whatever. So I did enjoy actually this, as you just said, this unitary experience. Now, I know bits of the rest of the Ring Cycle anyway, and what one of the primary ideas that are sort of slightly cemented in my mind as I was watching was this idea of, we don't see Wagner being funny a lot, or we don't perceive Wagner to be funny a lot, in the same way that lots of people have in mind the big moment of the Valkyrie or whatever. But as you just said, Paul, those moments are actually very short, and the rest of the opera is either very conversational, very little actually happens. In the same way, we don't often remember Wagner as, oh, someone who is able to make us laugh.
We don't remember the jokes.
And I thought, oh, that's interesting. This is the third of the Ring Cycle. The analogy with the way that a symphony would be created, you know, with the third movement being the scherzo, especially with, you know, Beethoven or whatever, which traditionally from the sort of late 18th, early 19th century can get this sort of slightly more humorous and ironic sort of flavour.
And a bit of light relief. And
exactly. I thought that was actually a good metaphor for that one, because we know what's going to happen. I mean, the people who know what Gota Hamanu is about, the last opera of the Ring cycle, is much more tragic throughout. So to give us this sort of, oh, life can be like, oh, so much about love and this hero who doesn't change and doesn't learn and doesn't, you know, actually there is something both beautiful and elevating and also a bit sad and already cynical and tragic behind, because again, we know what's going to happen. So I love that. And in terms of just Berikovsky's aesthetics, if you want to jump already towards that, I haven't seen a lot of his work, but I recognize the Gorida suit stuff. It seems to me that if people around the table know a bit more his stuff, there's some hit and miss. Sometimes one person I see as a stage director for opera, where I see sometimes very good stuff and much more questionable choices, is Ivo van Hove, for example. And it's like some of it can be really, really good, and some other stuff is just like, I don't even think you've opened the score. So maybe Berikovsky is a bit like, in what I've seen with Siegfried here at the Royal Opera House, I thought that was really well thought out, and I can tell you more about why I think it was.
It's an interesting comparison. I mean, you get the feeling that people like Ivo van Hove and Calixto Bieto, I mean, they go out of their way to annoy the specific audience that they're playing to. And I think Barry has had his moments doing that as well. And he certainly did in his last Ring cycle. Which he did in Hanover. Paul, you probably went to see it.
I didn't, actually. No, I missed that one.
Kind of 15 years ago or something. And everybody hated it. And the thing was that in that one, Berikovsky threw all his ideas at the wall. And, you know, you could have quite a lot of ideas about it. And he had to work, he kind of worked through the anti-Semitism aspect of The Ring as well. And so Mima was very Jewish and wearing a yarmulke and doing the whining and yodeling that Wagner described. I mean, Hanover's audience kind of used to Pink Chadon. I've been to a few shows there, and they specifically get directors who like to tell them that they're a gang of Nazis.
Yeah.
But that's German opera. That's how the way it goes in Germany.
But Bayreuth is the extreme example of that. I stopped going after the last Ring cycle because it was so bad. It was the worst I've ever seen. And it had people of the quality of Lisa Davidson as Brunhilde. I mean, you know, musically it was superb, but the production was so bad, and it really was like a beating for the Bavarians. Yeah. You are such bad people.
But it happens at Salzburg as well. You know, there was Hans Neuenfels. Neuenfels did that kind of Fledermaus, where they were doing a kind of Busby Berkeley routine. Everyone in the form of a swastika marching around, you know, and doing this. It's fair enough in Salzburg.
Well, that's actually, that can be confronted very well. German history, I mean, it should be confronted. It was very well done in the Meistersinger that ENO did.
I love that Meistersinger.
Which
the
I thought was
the Richard Jones one.
Absolutely, yeah, it was great.
It was superb.
Really good.
Yeah.
But coming back to the humour thing about Siegfried, and he is there in this production, but I think one of the reasons why is because of the Siegfried himself, Andreas Schäger, who was magnificent. Yes. I mean, he is the greatest Siegfried of his time. And it is just a horrible, thankless role, particularly by the time you get to the third.
I mean, we should say that. I mean, it's 4 hours of yelling, mostly high notes. I mean, you know, round about the break in the voice up there and higher, and just going and going and going.
Oh, absolutely. But then I think the point about the reason he can add that humour is because he's not so earnest about just getting through the performance. He's got space to be playful.
He's playing,
because
he's
got the energy, he's got the voice, he never gives up.
Yes.
It's extraordinary performance. And I've never seen a better Siegfried, I mean, to be quite honest. And that allows that space of humour and wit because of the sheer confidence of the performer.
Well, and he's, I mean, he's the kind of Siegfried of choice at the moment. I think everybody wants him. And whether he's going to, I don't know how many he's done, but I mean, whether he's going to burn out. I saw the third performance of Six. I think you were at the second.
I went first.
And even last night at the third, I mean, at the end you could see, okay, he probably doesn't want to sing that much more tonight. But he was still out singing Brunhilde, who'd only just woken up after, like, 6 years or whatever it was. No, many more years, wasn't it? Since he's been born. 20. How old is he? 19?
He's supposed to be a teenager, isn't
okay,
he?
So she's been asleep for 19 years. And
she's, yeah, she's quite...
I suppose you'd feel a little bit rusty.
Yeah, she's a bit of a cougar, I think.
But has she's remained, she's his aunt, come on. But she's, I think she's remained, she's had, it's kind of a beauty sleep. She's remained as she was. So she was not, you know, I think that she's not looking too auntie-like. On the other, you know, because he hangs out with the woodbird. We're going to get on to that.
Love the woodbird. Lola, you wanted to say something a bit earlier on, though.
No, but I mean, about what you've just said. Paul, about the Andras
Shager.
As you know, as myself, a singer, professionally trained when I was very young, one of the things I always look for on stage for singers is how is the voice developing throughout the act? Are we singing just a bit more of the same? Is it getting more powerful, more different? And it was after, as you said, like so many hours of yelling, was just developing even more his voice with even more timbre and colours and a sort of amazing technique at being able to still reach the high notes so powerfully and beautifully and technically very accurate but still generous. So all of that plus the acting, I know it's a massive cliche to say singers don't know how to act, but it's true. Most of them don't. Yeah.
And I think they are getting better. I mean, remember the first time I went to the opera, and I mean, there were people. We called it the highwayman pose. It was a stand and deliver, wasn't it? And
just,
yes.
I thought that most of them were able to play. I have some reservations about Brunhilde. Mm-hmm. I don't know if you want to go to this, but especially Siegfried or Mimer, etc., were able to play so, so well. And again,
and Christopher Moltmann.
Yes.
A beautiful voice.
All of that was really good. Yeah. And on the point, again on the comic and how Koski maybe has been playing a bit with frustrating the expectations or working against his audience, I thought there he went back to the basics. He went back to actually less is more, and you have a lot on stage. It's not so minimalist and so naked, but he was able to make us laugh with things that were very minimalist. So there is in the first act you mentioned the fireworks, and of course at the end there is the whole sword that he's putting up. And in the second act as well, he's sort of finding his sword, and at the very last note, sort of, again pushing it into the air, and everyone laughed. At least that was the case, and not our evening. But the little dog or bear or whatever, the little sort of puppet, it's so stupid, and I oh my gosh, that's a relief, and it does work. And I think that's maybe a
good solution to the bear problem.
Exactly, and a good solution. And it's like, maybe that's a wake-up call, hopefully, not just for Koski, but for many other people who do opera staging. You don't have to give us the usual stuff that is transgressive, you know, or wink-wink transgressive. And that's why I have to say, being very prejudiced, now that I've seen many different productions of different operas, when I entered the room and I saw the naked lady, I was like, are we going to go down that path? And actually not at all. I thought actually there was a bit on the line and it did work for me. But I think he was playing with a few different things.
I found the old woman who's playing old Earth. And there was a difficulty at one stage when she's playing old Mother Earth, and then you've got Erda, who is the Earth.
Yes. Let's just say that, just in case there's somebody listening who hasn't the faintest idea what's going on. Because you never know. I mean, of course, only Wagnerians are going to tune in. But, you know, you never know. Somebody might get stuck on the central line and maybe the last thing in the world before the apocalypse. And it's going to, pass there, you know, in which case, you know, it's been great knowing you. So Erda is the Earth goddess, the eternal Earth goddess. And Barry Koski's idea, obviously, which came long ago, was that she was going to be on stage throughout the entire 16 hours of the show, naked.
She's an 18-year-old woman with long grey hair, and she walks very, very, very slowly, which actually well done to her.
And an interesting physique. I thought actually that was part of why it worked for me, because she was not just obviously naked and sexualized. She was more like a weird gnome from
but
some sort of...
But there are two different ones.
Right, okay.
And they are quite
sorry.
Physically different.
Okay. Okay. My bad then. Did we have the good one or the bad one?
They're not necessarily bad. We had the larger one, shall I say.
I liked it. I thought it worked.
Alternating, I suppose, yes. But, yeah.
the reason why I found it just a bit irritating was because she's there on stage witnessing it all and everything else. And there's bits of it I kind of went, oh, actually, that I don't mind that so much. I didn't. But it slightly takes away from the rest of the action. Yeah. And I particularly loathed it in The Valkyrie because there seemed to be a lot of meandering about. And at one stage, the huge, great tree trunk, there's some sort of steam rising up and everything else. And honestly, she sort of searches for this thing and then sort of disappears into this tree knot, as it were. And honestly, to me, it looked like she was into a jacuzzi. Yeah. And for some reason, and not in a funny way, because it wasn't a funny piece of
well, it's not. She's very rarely comic. I mean, I think the thing is that, you know, having, you know, this is as I think, diminishing returns character. Mm. And having thought of it as a brilliant wheeze long before they started staging the thing, now he's locked into the kind of dreadful bits of having to get her into every scene and what am I going to do?
How's she going to be in Götterdämmerung, for goodness sake?
Well, they did this at the beginning of Das Rheingold at the ENO, didn't they? They had naked man walk across, the last one that was abandoned. In that one, they had a naked man. So it was very similar.
And it was kind of like Stone Age reference.
Yes, it was. He was a man evolving, basically, yes. And I got to this one and I'd heard about it and you think, oh, God, it's Barry Kosky. It's the least of our problems. Yes. And it sort of works as a representation of Erda and the Earth. But I thought it got really problematic in this one in particular. I agree with Penny about the Valkyrie one. Mm-hmm. But I think it got even worse this time for two reasons. One, it took away the singer of the Woodbird.
I know.
And so to me, as you said, Penny, it's one of the great moments in Siegfried because it's beautiful, but it's also one of those magical, Wagnerian, elongated, extended melodies that's instantly memorable. Yeah. And you think, how does he do that? Mm. It's really long, it's really complicated. And the first time you hear it, you memorize it. Mm. It's incredible. And so I felt very, very sorry at the curtain call for Sarah Dufresne, who had sung the Woodbird brilliantly. And there were probably people there saying, yeah, who's that? What was she doing?
So the Erda character, the silent, naked old lady, mouths the words rather poorly.
It's ridiculous.
Rather like Top of the Pops in the 1970s, wasn't it? While Sarah Dufresne sings off stage. I mean, and there are a million things actually wrong with that. One is that, I mean, this is, you know, 5 minutes before then, Siegfried is sitting down in the forest and suddenly, finally, solo violins emerge from the texture of the orchestra and they go up high and you think, oh yeah, there is a note above middle C in Wagner's musical lexicon. Forgotten about that. And so up it goes and it turns into this heavenly thing, the Siegfried Idyll, what will become the Siegfried Idyll that he played for Cosmer on her birthday, one time, and it's all lovely, nice birthday present. And the things, and then the flute comes out and starts doing the Woodbird song, and then the Woodbird starts doing her singing. But also, it's not just that, but it's also a design opportunity, isn't it? Because you can have a female character, and they've been at a premium in this very male opera, coming on stage. I remember the Scottish Opera one, came on, Woodbird comes on a scooter, and suddenly the whole atmosphere lightens, and she's wearing colours.
Yes.
And, you know, it kind of zips around, going,
that was a really good one.
And it's all absolutely lovely. And then I just thought it was a complete waste of a good design opportunity, among other
things. And plus, it's a bird, and you've got this old woman who's been wandering around, and all of a sudden she's miming badly.
I just to be clear, I'm not saying that was the best idea. I was very much on the fence from the start and throughout. I was just like, oh, actually, you know what? Fine. I think that's the least of our problems in a way. But I thought actually, typically that, I thought it was so funny because she was opening her mouth so wide and it was a bit grotesque and strange and a bit disgusting, but also like, oh, fun. Like,
but also, the interaction between her and Siegfried was quite sweet.
Yeah.
They were quite nice as they were sitting together, like him and his granny, and not saying, you know, it's like she's come out of a loony bin and she's forgotten her clothes or something,
yeah,
right?
Exactly.
And he's being kind of nice to her. And they were quite sweet together.
Yeah.
But you still want to have the actual bird there. And also it raised, like, very, you know, problems about, or questions about what the hell this woman is doing on stage in the first place. So Barikowski has made it very clear that this is all about environmental collapse and so forth.
Oh,
of course,
no.
You have to have... I'm so pleased you said that. That's so good, Lola, because you only know this if you've read the blasted programme note. And nobody should have to buy this damn thing. How much are they charging? At least 10 quid. Nobody should have to buy that to find out what the hell is supposed to be happening on stage.
No, you should actually...
It's really an incredibly annoying thing.
And that is when, productions go wrong. I mean, I've been to see productions where I've come out and I've just thought, I know this story, I know what's going on, but I have no idea what they were doing. Do you remember that when there was a triumvirate at one stage at the Colosseum where there was always a chair stuck halfway up a wall or a bed?
It was David Pountney's chair on the wall and a searchlight, but barbed wire, somebody carrying
a
suitcase.
Every single time.
But I think this is one of the reasons why the Country House stuff has worked. And I think Loughborough takes a lot of credit for this, of what's happened there over the years, of a really pared down productions of Wagner, which you can do because of this conversational nature we've already discussed. And I've been with people like to Wagner at Loughborough, and they've seen stuff like The Flying Dutchman. They've seen it at the Royal Opera House, they've seen it at English National Opera. They then sit and they think, oh, I get what it's about now. Because they just tell the story. And
although that's not what it is about, right?
It's about sewing machines, isn't it? According to one of the productions I saw.
It is that point that these are made for people like us who've seen it a million times and know the plot and the story and presumably the nuances of all that. But this one's not too bad. It's quite stark, and you wonder how much this has been made by cuts, the economics of opera now, that the places where this has gone wrong is where they spend too much money on opera, in Germany, in Austria, we've already talked about that, and actually the saving grace of British opera, where I think you see Wagner... They can't afford to do that stuff on the whole.
You see, when you talk about that, some of the best productions I've seen of things, I mean, I remember many years ago going to see Così fan tutte with it, and it was a small company called The Opera Factory. And they were singing whilst in deck chairs. They got tangled up in deck chairs. It was very funny.
I think it was at the Drill Hall.
And another one that I saw at the Trafalgar Studios too, which was this tiny little theatre, which is where they had it all in English. It was just a cello and a pianist. And they'd all. Mimi was a drug addict. Marcello was actually a painter and decorator. Rudolph, he wrote Amazon reviews for things like hairstyling products and various other things.
This is the opera up close job in Kilburn.
Yeah. And they also did it on Trafalgar. So all I'm saying is that as long as you've got a good cast, I mean, I do think the cast is nowadays is so important. Because if you go along something and it's a bit pants, you can close your eyes during the bits that annoy you. Because I was sitting on the third kind of, I had a sort of one of those oblique angles, kind of mostly over the orchestra, but I could, if I virtually hang over by my toe tips, I could actually see the whole stage. You know, it was one of those. But that meant that in the bits where I was annoyed by the naked woman wandering around, I just closed my eyes for a little bit until another bit came along, and then I just, you know, I mean, there were slightly things. For example, when the bird was there, when the wood bird was there, the brilliant thing was I was one of the few who could see the wood bird singing.
Okay.
She was right beside Papano. Beside Antonio Papano. So when she started singing, and of course, like everybody else, I was thinking, where is she? I looked down and there she was singing. So I just kept my eyes on her and stopped looking at Siegfried, sort of, you know, and the miming Mother Earth.
See, I think the problem with that is, I mean, that's all good. So as we were talking about Barikowski's apocalypse, Anthropocene, blah, blah, right? Which as Lola's kind of making vomiting emoji faces and stuff, and quite rightly, because like, who doesn't do that now? Isn't that like, this is like some kind of teenage old hat stuff. But hang on a fair second, Lola. And Erda is the representative of this. So Erda, the deal is, the reason Erda's on stage the entire time is that she's dreaming it. It's the dream of the previous, how everything went tits up. And going into, I mean,
hold on a second. Are we talking like... about Bobby from Dallas when he suddenly realised it was all a dream? Is this what it is? Well, is that what it is? So we've gone from butterflies to Dallas.
Bouchard Jail.
And so you know, and so like technically at the end of Götterdämmerung, I mean, everything, the Rhine overflows, Valhalla goes up in flames and stuff. But actually, you know, okay, so that's the way that Barry Kosky is clearly going to do it, as you know, the end of the world in some way. But Wagner presents it as the end of the world in a way which clears it's kind of his anarchist phase. When he wrote Siegfried's Death, he was going very, very much through his anarchist phase, and Siegfried is Bakunin and so forth, and this destruction of all existing structures, allowing the new humanity free of gods and religion and law and contracts.
It was
a kind of Swedish death clean. But it means that, you know, whoever survives, even if it's like cockroaches and mice, is going to have a great time. It's party time, right, for cockroaches and mice. It's not bad for everybody. And I think that's kind of Wagner's point. But, you know, Barry wants us all to be like, in the usual kind of anthropocentric way. We're supposed to say, oh, God, we're all going to wipe ourselves out. Well, who cares? The Earth won't care when we wipe ourselves out, will it? Erda won't care. She'll just heave a huge sigh of relief and say, okay, let's try again with some cockroaches.
But why was Lola making emoji faces? Sorry, I'm confused.
Because it's so boring to do environmental disruption.
But that's a kind of replacement of the way we think about politics now, isn't it? Because now environmentally so central to political debate. Mm. It's kind of eschatological way of viewing the world. Whereas if you think back to the centenary, Patrice Chéreau and the Boulez one, which was a Marxist interpretation at the heart. And that's a kind of renewal. It's almost, people say it's Marxist, but it's also a bit Nietzsche in that idea of recurrence, that eternal recurrence thing. And so it just reflects the political obsessions and ideologies of the time.
I mean, this is the thing. We're talking about it being kind of a quite a stark and bare staging, but I'm sitting there thinking, well, you know, what's Barry Kosky for, actually? I mean, he's making some nice stage pictures and stuff like that, but what does he think about this? I'd like, you know, if there's going to be a director, I'd like to know what he thinks, and I don't get any.
Sorry, actually, that's the point I wanted to go back to. I don't care what he thinks at all. I think that's shocking.
Well, you could save a lot of money then. You could not hire him.
And on the therapy after having read it. But also, I think it's a typical case of sometimes in some context or just for sheer curiosity, it is interesting to understand what an artist has done or think they've done with their work. But sometimes just let the work speak for itself. Mm. So I really liked most of what he presented to us. Now that I'm hearing the political motivation or politically infused motivation, indeed I don't like that. But I think I can separate the man from, you know, the artist from the work. And if he wants to look at it from an anthropocentric whatever thing, fine, good for him. But there are a few things that he presented, whether they worked despite what he actually wanted to do, or against what he wanted to do, or just again because there is something at work in the work that is exalting something, it was present. When you talked about the phase of Wagner being slightly anarchist, we see it on stage. It's there. We can see Wotan a bit like the clergy, and Mimer a bit more like the sort of, you know, aristocracy or whatever. Obviously, Siegfried being the working class guy who wants to sort of just do something great with his life, and as he does so, and as he forges again the sword, and of course, and we see the man at work, and his sweat and his blood or whatever, sort of being able to transcend this hierarchy. It's there. Whether Barry Kosky agrees with it or not, it's right there. And the element of the nature for me was slightly more elevated and transcendent than whatever it is that he thinks about it. I have the program, I haven't read that. That's complete crap. And it's just that, and I think this is typically when you were asking me at the start, like, you know, as a Unitarian experience, sometimes it's good. Come with a fresh pair of eyes and work even against what the artist has tried to do. Because ultimately, if they have good instincts, which I'm actually quite persuaded, Barry Kosky being educated the way he's been, has some interesting natural instinct at things. you can see it, and the cast, as you said, is really good, and so it participates in elevating this experience. But if the point is about just the Earth and really just about that, well, he's failed at his mission. I'm glad he did fail that.
I mean, the thing is that it's correctly. I mean, it's a parable, right? It's not about a dragon. And it demands interpretation or some kind of intellectual something, because it was when Wagner wrote it, he definitely wrote it as a kind of revolutionary critique of modern civilization as it was then, 19th century civilization, whether it was industrialization or whatever. But just about kind of, because he was going through his Bakunin phase, it was a critique of everything that had led to the kind of awfulness of the late 19th century. I mean, and quite rightly so. And everything, but church and laws being not, as it turned out, for the benefit of everybody, and actually constraining humanity and so forth. And the vision was the destruction of this and the birth of the new humanity. And so there's only so much future in us kind of repeating that. Mm. I mean, it invites an interpretation in terms of the present day, because, I mean, those problems have not changed, have they?
Well, it is
inexhaustible
as well. But I think if we go back to what Penny made about the relationships, mm-hmm. is that on the one side, there is this fantastic world of dragons and dwarfs and gods and so. But it's a very human thing. And it's like all great works of art, it's inexhaustible. It could be interpreted for as long as there are human beings, and no doubt it will be. It's like Shakespeare on that level. But Shakespeare with music, an even greater achievement,
And a lot more incest.
A great deal more incest, yes.
Goodness sake, they're all related, aren't they? It's like Mutiny on the Bounty. They're all...
That's Pitcairn Island. We can say, let's do the ring on Pitcairn Island. It'll be like, say, Fletcher Christian as... Who will Fletcher be? I mean, which character do you see Fletcher Christian as?
Fletcher Christian, well, surely he would be Votan with all those children all over the shop everything else. But everybody's related and everybody's having rows everywhere, and Votan and his missus having a bit of a row about this, and even the Norns aren't all in agreement.
No, it's very much a kind of family sitcom or family, family soap opera.
This is EastEnders, my pub.
Yeah. And there's always that shadow in the background. So it really struck me this time, it's like this thing where you always think about something new, despite the production, it escapes the powers of the director. But Logan is there throughout.
And he comes into the music. When Mima and Votan, when Votan's doing his stupid 20 questions game with Mima.
Which is rubbish, 20 questions. Surely after the first one, you'd say, oh, you know all about that stuff. I'll ask you a different one.
That's
about what's the only thing that's always in your fridge? I mean, would have been a much better second question. You open it and there's always eggs. Full stop.
This is because, the kind of radio phone in the show and this kind of thing hadn't happened when he was writing this, and so they needed you.
Third question: where do all the single socks go? Answer, please. Something useful.
That's exactly the point. But in that, when Mima's doing his head in about some stupid question or answer, Loga music appears and Fafner music appears, and they're all layered up and beautiful.
Loga's the only one who's at the very end, really, as well.
I mean, and of course, Loga is the only intelligent character in the ring, and he's not there for most of it. It's really annoying. I just wish he was, although I hated the Loga, actually, in The Rheingold. Yeah. I thought it was really overdone and annoying. But he's when he's properly done, Loga is just a great character. It's like, it's funny, and he hates everybody, and he has an incredibly low opinion. I mean, okay, I think we're describing ourselves again.
I was just thinking, and he's wearing some kind of shooting gilet and stripy shirt. Oh, hold on a second.
I was thinking more of you three. I saw us. It's like, which character do you want to be in, like, all worlds, history and literature? And everyone says, oh, Cassandra, of course. But also, after Cassandra, I would go for Logo. No? Yeah. Any thoughts on that? Well, okay, which ring character would you like to be? Fafner's cool, obviously. I wouldn't mind being Fafner.
Yeah,
except, oh my goodness, to be what? Stuck in a cave with all that,
sleeping! Oh,
yes, I know,
sweet,
but
sweet
endlessly
sleep.
Sleeping. I don't know. I mean,
there's no great choice, is there?
No, exactly.
Nobody comes out great. I mean, I suppose Brunhilde comes, if you could, apart from the sati bit at the end.
I think I'd quite like to be Votan. Just Votan.
Yes, I think Votan probably.
For the power, for the power, yes.
For the power, yeah. And also, it's quite nice having a big long stick. As a committed walker and hiker, I love a good old pokey stick.
Yeah. Do you think, I mean, who is the central character of this, do you think, that we're watching? Who's the...
Of Siegfried. Or the whole thing.
Of this ring that we're watching.
Oh, of the whole ring, sorry.
Votan may be a tiny bit much more important, maybe.
I mean, because there are obviously like three or four centres, and Votan and Siegfried and Brunhilde. I mean, it could be anyone. Erda, you see, is Erda the one?
The moments when Erda is on stage, they hit. They ring.
That's true. Although she just says, oh, did you wake me up for that? Piss off.
That was so good. And she's also very poorly treated, right? He sort of takes almost by the hair and drags us out of her little pit of earth or whatever, and she's back at him. That again, in terms of relationship, is both gods talking to one another and also being not quite childish, but close to that, sort of teenagers being, what do you care about what I'm, you know, what do you want to do or whatever?
Votan doesn't treat anybody that well, right? He's quite disrespectful.
Yeah, but she's back also as well, you know, she's just, you know.
As a leitmotif, Votan's got a good one.
Oh, God.
True.
I mean, they all have, but I'm just saying that Votan in particular, whenever the Votan one comes out, I go, ooh, nice, I like that one.
I'll have that.
I wonder if there's something about time as well. If you're there forever, like Erda is, there is a kind of boredom that must set in at some point. And that's the way she reacts.
I mean, there is a limit to how much cooking or sewing or anything else you could do on your own.
And this is before the age of social media.
I was going to say, this is part of the anarchist Wagner's face where he already thought of Me Too movement before it was the time. But anyway...
Well, I mean, the thing is, didn't he think of everything? This is, you know, because, I mean, the ring, what is it? It's like a kind of cathedral. I mean, it's the equivalent of a work of art, of a cathedral, if one bloke thought it up, designed it and built it. I can't think of anything that compares to the ring.
Rather familiar, perhaps, in Barcelona.
I mean, as a kind of one-man job, is there anything outside the Sistine Chapel that compares to the painting of the Sistine Chapel?
Who compares to it? I mean, if you think of the circumstances, he's just written. Mm. By the time he comes to the third act, he's written Tristan and Isolde and Die Meistersinger, which either of those alone would be a kind of transcendent work of...
Yeah, it would be a good CV.
Western genius. And then he comes out with the third act of Siegfried.
Well, but in a way, thank God he did, because, I mean, I've never heard it quite so clearly as I did last night. Is how much better Act Three is musically than what comes before.
It's a leap. It's a giant leap.
Musically, yes, it was great. In terms of just the plot thing, I thought it was one of those classic third act. Oh, what am I scratching your head? What am I going to talk about? Now they've sort of found themselves, and for about 30 more minutes, they just talk. Love you back. Do you really love me? Yes, I do. Like, can we please be together?
I mean, I think the last duet wasn't. I mean, usually it doesn't, or sometimes it doesn't have to feel that long. I think, I thought it felt pretty long. Yeah. As they just kind of bellowed at each other and kind of gambled around in a quite leaden way, I felt.
Yeah.
Nice flowers, though. And
flowers
I thought.
Were good.
And actually, for the first time, because so many Siegfrieds, because of course she's on the rock, surrounded by the ring of fire and everything else, and quite often that particular bit is quite grey. And the worst thing about, for me, about a production is when there's a lot of grey, because I'm a bit like a canary. If you put I go to sleep, you know, if it's too dark, that's it. Nice and warm, toasty. I'll just have I'll just read the inside of my eyelids. And I thought that actually, I rather liked it. And I mean... My problem was the bad thing about being where I was sitting was that I could see the lump under the flowers. So I knew she was there, whereas I know people in the stalls would not have seen that.
Well, I kind of assumed she was there. It wasn't just talking to the flowers.
No, I know. But I'm just saying that the nice thing about it means that presumably your vision is roaming a bit more, whereas I was just waiting with my vision on the hump.
Mm. And was that convincing?
No, so it made it less convincing is what I'm saying. So I'm saying I was sitting there going, when's the hump going to move?
But that's funny you say this, because I think it was intended towards the end, not from the start. So just a question of perspective. But he at the very end, he takes away the sort of frame, this sort of grey, interesting, well-patined frame that is, you know, moving both forward and backwards during all of the act. And he removes that, those little walls, and you see the bare theatre, yeah, which is sort of wink, wink, we are at the theatre, you know, right. Bergen. Well, but it was fairly well. What I agree with is that I thought that was really interesting. That was a really good choice. That both could be read as we are offering contrast with what happened before, and I don't think it's all minimalistic. I think the rest is slightly more than just bare minimum. It made me think a lot about Beckett. I thought they were.
They looked like Beckett characters.
They looked very much like Beckett characters.
I mean, it looked like Bill Bailey playing Beckett.
All of this, at least most of the staging, really made me think of some sort of Beckett play, including the start of the third act, because there are two different stagings that made me think of, I don't know how it's called in English, but in French it's Olé Beaujour, where you have two characters that are stuck in little piles of earth or sand or something like this.
Happy Days.
So it really made me think, oh, there must be, again, whether he wants it or not, whether it's subliminal or not, there is an element of Beckett of everything is sort of in waiting. We are passing through. We're just waiting for something to happen. And then there is this moment of Garden of Eden, almost, mm-hmm. where the light gets progressively even more bright, mm-hmm. almost blinding. Yes. And then, of course, he removes the frame around. And I think, again, there's two readings of that. One is contrast, happy time, the lovers are together. And the cynical reading for those who know what's going to happen later is, oh, this is actually not really happy, friendly, lieto fine. Yeah. This is actually maybe the last glimpse of hope or love or whatever before the innocence before the very end. There's going to be
Before the fall. I mean, there's a very Christian analogy, isn't there? Absolutely, because they're about to have sex as well. Because which, as we know, is a bad thing to do.
Oh my goodness! Let's hope that the Earth Woman isn't going to take part.
I mean, not only through our upbringing, but also through all opera, we know that sex is a blood sport, and they do it at your peril.
I did also want to say that I thought that the costumes really worked, because I loved from the moment that Mima came on. I know the very first thing is the feet swinging away, and I just thought, oh dear, I know who those feet are going to belong to. Yes, exactly. But then you get Mima arriving, who looks like some sort of skanky bloke in a tank top and a colander for a hat and all the rest of it. And I thought that, and Siegfried is kind of a teenager who's probably wearing the same things all the time, and you mentioned Votan already. And I thought that the dragon's outfit, at the beginning, I wasn't sure about it. And then I really did
like it. The dragon grew on you.
The dragon grew on me.
Loved it.
When he came on, there was this man who absolutely guffawed hysterically as soon as he appeared. But he did grow.
And he's a really good singer.
Well, he was amplified. He didn't need to be amplified, but he was. And they gave him a kind of booming reverb, so he came on in this, I think it was covered in rhinestones, but a big gold suit.
No, it's a big gold suit, which I found out later was 3D laser printed.
Mm. Okay.
Yeah, in small batches and then sewn together.
How much did it cost?
20p.
I'll have one.
I have no idea. You would look great in it, but would you ever be able to sit down again? I mean, your trip in the tube would be very difficult.
I mean, but the thing is, okay, so you've got to do something with the dragon, and that was. But, you know, Barry Kosky at the beginning said, Siegfried, you know, in order to work, it's got to be funny and it's got to be scary. It wasn't scary.
Oh, no, it wasn't scary.
It was funny with the jokes that he put in when Votan offers Alberic a crisp.
That was funny.
That was very good.
But he had to invent the jokes, right? And when he lost his sword, that was funny. Forgot his sword. But they were invented.
But it was anxious. I think it was more, and I think this is where there is some Beckett element of it. It's more like, oh gosh, no, we know something's wrong. We know, but at the same time, the laugh or whatever makes us think, oh, this may be more cynical than anything else. So I wasn't scared, but I did feel some form of anxiety of.
I think the thing is, the music is incredibly baleful and brooding until the birdie comes along. And that's what I think that Tony Papano doesn't do very well, actually, is the kind of intensity of the brooding and all that. Because the first act is really difficult. It's just people kind of singing not very memorable tunes over the leitmotifs in a kind of accompanied recitative kind of way that we're familiar with from Handel and, you know, Mozart, up-to-date version. And in order to work, it needs to really have a kind of arc, and I just don't think Tony's got that, but that's, you know, that's my subjective thing.
Well, there you go. You see, the thing is that I know nothing about these things. I just know what I like, and I sit there and enjoy myself. I thought they were great, and
my point is that you have to...
And I thought it was lovely that at the end, the orchestra came onto the stage, and that's the first...
No, of course you're absolutely right, Penny, and one can be over-specialist about this kind of stuff and say, yes, I remember Zabba Leone doing it in 1953.
Isn't Zabba Leone in Italian pudding?
As well as a well-known Wagnerian conductor, and how marvellous it was. Now, the point that, you know, Wagner's going to survive pretty much anything. We've seen it done, you know, by Regent's Opera really well in the Freemasons Hall and this kind of thing, by a little 19-piece orchestra. Of course, they did it marvellously. They're a brilliant orchestra. He's a brilliant conductor. They played it marvellously. I'm just thinking, in an incredibly over-specialised way, I like more anguish in my anguished music.
I would say the two moments, at least for me, that were closer to that and not just my anxiety was the dispute between the two brothers, Albrecht and Mimer, where you really can feel, and again, the music just works for itself, you really can feel the hatred, the sheer hatred between two brothers.
Yeah.
And then obviously the tragic element already at play through that.
Yeah.
And then the moment that Siegfried kills Mimer, despite the fact that we sort of know it's going to happen and Mimer has sort of deserved it or whatever, there is still, as you said, that thing at the start, like, Mimer has taken on that boy,
yeah,
of course for the bad reasons,
yeah,
but also he's been and I think that killing,
exhausted.
And he's exhausted, yeah,
yeah,
and that killing still feels a bit like, oh no, oh wait, no, oh that's really sad actually. But again, because Koski plays with the comic aspect of the opera, I think it's also redeemed, and maybe in a negative way, as in like we sort of forget about this this angst when Siegfried searches for his weapon that had killed previously not just the Fafnir the dragon but also his adopted father.
Yeah.
And he, instead of staying this sort of deadly weapon that has killed two people of importance, he sort of brandishes in the air like a toy, and again we go back to, oh, he's still a boy in a way.
But it is a toy, isn't
yeah.
it? Because it's the same point about, you know, he hasn't had sex. He doesn't understand what that is. He doesn't really understand what killing is.
Yes.
He doesn't understand what
love,
death is.
Yeah.
And if you think about opera, you know, you think of Peter Conrad's book, you know, it's tales of sex and death.
Yeah.
He doesn't get either of them at that point.
Yeah.
But the moment he does, it all goes very, very sour. We're going to have to wind this up, which is a shame, because we could go on for hours, couldn't we?
And then we'd have to have an 80-minute interval and a 60-minute other way around.
Dinner.
I mean, it sounds like everybody, you know, did you see the Opera North one where they did it kind of semi-staged on stage?
Well,
on the
yeah,
festival?
I thought the Opera North one was fantastic.
It was fantastic.
And I took someone...
Because it allows the thing to, you know, because Wagner can speak for itself, then we're allowed to think our own thoughts and stuff like this. But once you employ a director...
Yeah, well, I think it's been very influential. I think the two things that have been influential in British opera are the Opera North one.
Mm.
One, because it's now the one that people can watch.
Yeah.
Because it's on YouTube as well. It's there, the whole thing. It's told very straight. You get your captions up there. You know exactly what's going on.
Yeah.
It's got a good cast, a brilliant conductor. And the Loughborough one, which is also there on YouTube. They're pared down. They're small scale, but they tell the story.
Wasn't that small scale. They had a pretty big...
Yeah, but it tells a story straight.
Yeah.
It tells the story completely
straight.
Well,
it was directed by the lighting designer, Peter Mumford. I mean,
yeah,
you know, he did a brilliant job. Yeah. I mean,
it was absolutely superb.
Yeah.
And I would say that the Channel 4 cartoon series of Wagner's Ring Cycle was also very influential, because that was the first time.
Didn't Bugs Bunny do it as well?
Really? I loved that Channel 4.
I got a big picture of Bugs Bunny as Brunhilde. I mean, I don't know whether that's me or...
I don't think that was the one from Channel 4, but anyway,
okay.
I really liked it, yeah. No, I just thought that those things, I think that the more you kind of just bring... I think, you know, with old Timothy Chalamet...
Mm.
Talking on about, you know, opera being a dying art, ballet being a dying art.
Did he say, and macrame being a dying art.
Did he say macrame? No, he talked about ballet and opera. Despite his mother being a ballerina or something. It's a very Freudian thing anyway, you know, Oedipian.
So I think that that anything that keeps it there, because it is, once you get to it, I mean, it's not for everybody, just like jazz isn't for everybody, right. or painting isn't for everybody, or anything, everybody's welcome. Yeah. And actually, I think anything that makes it more accessible and makes it more interesting, and unlike, you know, old Timmy, I do think it's got a future, and I've seen some terrific operas. I will continue to go.
It seems to be incredibly healthy in this country, far more, I think, than on the continent.
I mean, but actually, the private sector kind of more than but you know, one hopes E&O is going to find its way through the Arts Council nonsense. Anyway, let's come back next year to discuss the end of the world, unless the end of the world has already happened. Thanks to President Trump. What do you think? But if it hasn't, then we'll be back next year, won't we? But we'll talk about something else in the meantime. I think this has been remarkably successful. We must do this. This is like the intelligent late review, finally, what the world has been waiting for. Thank you so much.
If you enjoyed this podcast, then why not subscribe to have the magazine delivered directly to your door? Our current offer is just £25 for 5 issues, and less than £45 for an entire year of Britain's best in-print publication. Subscribe now at www.thecritic.co.uk. ¶¶